Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Making the Game from Concept to Kickstarter. I am your host, Reese, and we are back. I apologize for the long delay since our last episode, but I will explain why it's been such a long break, but it's really good to be back. In this episode, we will discuss the run-up to the Kickstarter, what we learned, what we think we could have done better, and generally just give a recap on where we are at this point. In short, preparing for the Kickstarter was a lot more time and labor intensive than anticipated. On top of that, we have a very large gaming convention that we run in Las Vegas called the Las Vegas Open, and we decided to do the two at the same time because we thought it would give a lot of synergistic energy and attention to the project. Upon getting home, I got extremely sick, like scary sick, got better, went to my business partner's bachelor party, got back, and then got sick again because my wife had gotten sick in the meantime. And on that note, I am getting married. I'm already legally married last year, but we're having our ceremony in the church this year in the summer. So as soon as I recovered from illness, had to start putting some work in on real life stuff, getting caught up on other work. And then immediately we had to move in the beginning of April. So it was extremely hectic there for a long period of time. And just now getting back into a normal rhythm. All that said, thank you for your patience, and in this episode, we will be discussing the lessons learned from the Kickstarter. And to our great joy, it was a success. So thank you so much to everyone that backed the project and helped it come to life. We couldn't have done it without you. We're extremely grateful and very, very excited to get this project off the ground, out of our heads, and into your hands and your gaming table. We are currently busy at work finishing the last parts of the game that need to be done in preparation for going into production. So thank you to everyone that gave us feedback during the Kickstarter process. We are working on implementing some of those very good tips into the game before we finalize it. Before I dive into the nitty-gritty of what we learned in the Kickstarter process, I wanted to give a quick point about the future of the podcast. Now that we're settled into our new home, I will be back into a regular weekly schedule. I do plan to continue answering questions asked by listeners. Keep firing those questions over. The best place to do that is in the Facebook group, which I'll include links to that on the associated posts with this podcast, or on the Frontline Gaming blog. Those are the most visible places that I will see the comments. I also plan on setting this up as a video cast as well. My new place is better suited to it than our old place. And hopefully I want to be able to eventually get this into a stream format as well, probably live stream on YouTube. And that way I can answer questions on the fly for anyone that's listening and is curious about maybe clarification on a rule, the future of where we want to go with things, where we're at in the development process and all that sort of stuff, so that I can maintain maximum transparency and make sure that everybody understands how to play the game when they get their hands on it. What that means in terms of format is that it'll probably turn more into a stream of consciousness style podcast over time. This isn't something that's going to happen immediately. I spend quite a bit of time editing the podcast now to keep it as short and concise as possible, but to do some of the things that I think will be better for the show and the game long term, it will probably have a little bit less polish, just to put that out there. All right, so let's jump into the nitty gritty. So one of the things that we really underestimated in our ramp up to the Kickstarter was simply how much work was involved in getting everything ready. What I mean by that specifically is building the Kickstarter page, getting all the pledge levels set up, mapping out things like shipping and all of these other logistical, less sexy parts of making a game and bringing it to Kickstarter. We started 2 months out, and I wish we would have started like 4, maybe even 6 months out. Now, we had done a ton of research in advance, and we went into it feeling somewhat prepared. It was our first time doing this. Now, technically, we've done another Kickstarter, but it was many, many years ago in the early days of Kickstarter, and a different person that's no longer a part of our team actually did all the Kickstarter, like, logistical stuff of setting it up, getting the graphics and things of that nature. So despite the fact that we have had a successful Kickstarter in the past, this was a new experience for our current team. So as it ended up going, I was literally working 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that's not an embellishment in the slightest. Part of that, the reason that there was so many grueling hours was the fact that I was working in so many different time zones. So for example, the company Hexy Studios that was doing our really, really nice intro video there in Poland, and the manufacturer that we're working with on this one is in China. So it was really difficult. Like the busiest times for me were in the middle of the night and early morning, things of that nature. The slowest part of my day was actually the middle of the day. And that was when I had a chance to kind of get a little bit of a breather. And knowing all of that now, of course, going into the next Kickstarter that we want to do for the game, for Blood Throne, we'll be able to plan this out much more effectively. You know, just due to our lack of experience, we found ourselves in a situation where it was trying to do too many things at once. Couple this with the fact that we were gearing up for our big event, the Las Vegas Open, which is extremely time demanding on its own. It's a huge, you know, thousands and thousands of people come to play in tabletop gaming events. So trying to do all those things at the same time was extremely demanding on the limited 24 hours in the day. Now you might be asking yourself, why would you put so much on your plate? And in retrospect, that's a very good question. So for us, we thought that debuting the product and launching the Kickstarter at the LVO would give us a lot of gas in the tank. You know, the people at the event, they know who we are, they're familiar with us. We thought it was a brilliant marketing opportunity and one that we did not want to miss. And in retrospect, I don't think that was the right call. I think what would have been the wiser choice would be to debut the product, to show the intro video, have some promotional material, but not launch the Kickstarter while at the event. And I'll go into that more in more depth further into the podcast, but that was definitely a lesson learned. On the topic of the intro video, we worked with a company called Hexy Studios. They're great. Like I said, they're based out of Poland. They've done intro videos for games like The Witcher, which was extremely successful on GameFound. They were great to work with. Their price was very reasonable for the quality. The quality was excellent. You can see that video on the YouTube channel or on the Kickstarter or the pledge manager that's open now over at GameFound. They did a great job. They worked super hard. They were very responsive. A little bit of a language barrier, not too bad, but they were great. And I highly recommend them to anybody who's looking for a similar service. Making one of these digital intro videos is pretty complex. So you have to be able to get the video maker, obviously all of the STL files for the models, but you also have to get renders of all of the physical components. Now they can do a lot of it, but some of it was outside of their purview. For example, we have really cool 3D pop-up terrain in our game that makes it look much cooler than your typical board game. We had to actually find somebody that could take that design, render it, and then we got that to the studio. And then, of course, there were scaling issues. We had to make sure that everything was scaled the same. Obviously, in America, we use the imperial system, just feet and inches, and you know, most of the world uses the metric system. So at first, we had buildings that were like super tiny compared to the models. It was funny. But trying to work through all that in 30 days, for the first time, was very stressful. And we literally got the video done like 2 days before we needed it. So another tip, another lesson learned, obviously doing it a second time for us, it'll be way smoother, much easier, but give yourself twice or three times as much time to get that done as you think you will need. And go into it having done a lot of research. I had looked at a ton of videos before I went into it. So I had a pretty good idea of what I wanted to do, but I was still getting a lot of feedback from them because, again, I've never done anything like this before. So it was also getting over that learning curve hump of, okay, well, we want to show the models, we want to show the game, we want some dice rolling, and they have a ton of experience, so they gave us some of their ideas, which helped a ton as well. But in a nutshell, going into that, do a lot of research, talk to a lot of studios, watch a lot of videos, and figure out as best you can what you want to do in advance. From there, you'll work together on a script. Luckily, we have pretty strong writing skills on our team, so we were able to write a good script. And then doing the like shot by shot, okay, in scene one, this is what we want, and you have to set up models and shoot a film on your like cell phone, kind of showing them like this is what we're trying to do. And then from there, there's a back and forth. And the end result I felt was great, but holy cow. For the next one, we're going to start working on that way further out so that it's not such a crunch at the end. The other part of the process that was much more difficult than we thought it would be, again, due to our inexperience in having done it, was developing all the graphic assets for the Kickstarter page itself. So we have a ton of experience making graphic assets. We do it literally every week for our normal business, Frontline Gaming. This we thought would be relatively easy for us, but again, much, much more complicated than we thought it would be. And I'll explain why. So first of all, there's simply the volume of assets that you need. If you look at modern tabletop gaming Kickstarter pages, they scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll. And it's not done just to be, you know, obnoxious or whatever. It's just, there's a lot of information that you're trying to convey and you only get a brief amount of time that someone's going to look at your Kickstarter page, right? If they come at all. So when they come, you need to grab their attention immediately. So you need really, really good graphic assets that do a good job of explaining what the game is and why they should consider backing it. So you need high quality and you need a lot of them, not only to explain the game, but the pledge levels, any stretch goals, any add-ons, what makes your game unique, how far are you into the process. Basically explaining everything in sort of a visual format. Obviously you use a lot of words as well, but you need compelling images, right? And then of course you have to make sure that everything's spelled correctly, and if you miss some, you have to go back and change it. So that part of it was actually the easiest part, but it was a lot of work. Our graphic designer on staff was putting in some crazy hours to get it all done. The other part of it that was a lot more challenging than anticipated was getting all the renders of the models in a position that felt natural with all the other assets. So obviously at this stage, you're probably not taking pictures of the actual game. You're using renders, digital renders, based off of the cut files or the STLs for the miniatures or whatever the case may be. And for those of you who are wondering what I'm talking about, the STL is the file, that the digital file for the model that then you use to make the molds and such. And we'll talk about that in another episode because it's very complex. It's very interesting as well. But then things like the tokens and the cards, and then for us, the 3D terrain and the hero boards, the campaign board, and all these other three-dimensional assets, they don't look the way they come out of the box in the file. Like, they're flat, right? So it's a cut file, meaning that's what you send to the machinery that prints it and cuts it out. And then the end user puts it together to make it look the way you want it to look. So we had to have a different artist take those files, put them together, make them look three-dimensional, and then put them all into a setting, and then try to have a aesthetically pleasing composition, have the scale of the models and the assets as close as you can get them, and then convey all that into as few graphic assets as possible. That took us like a day and a half just to get that part of it done. Not to mention just rendering all of the models. I mean, Bloodthrone is packed. There's a ton of models. They're extremely detailed. Some of them are quite big. So just getting all those renders, just the time what it takes for the computer to do that, to render them and then put them at the angle that you want so that they all look natural, so they don't look like they're, you know, you don't get that uncanny valley sensation that they're not oriented correctly in relationship to them, to each other, or the surface of the play surface, etc. So that kind of caught us by surprise. That took a lot longer than we anticipated to get that to look nice. The end result, though, is that I feel like our Kickstarter looked extremely polished and professional. Now, we did make a couple mistakes. There was a few things that we added mid-campaign because we missed it. But I'm really proud of what we got, considering that we're a small company and this was our first board game Kickstarter. So it made us look professional. We were very, in my opinion, we're comparable to any of the big companies that are out there doing Kickstarters all the time, like CMON or any of these other companies. Now, there's still room for improvement, but we were really pleased with the visual presentation of our Kickstarter. Some of the things I think we didn't do as well as we could have in that respect was communicating more clearly just what is the game and why should people be excited about it? Where are we at in the development process? Because we had already started making the molds. That ended up being one of the strongest selling points of our product, and we didn't even mention it, except very briefly in some text. So we ended up making a new graphic asset later showing one of the completed molds and one of the production models and saying like, hey, look, we're way further into this process than most games are, meaning you're not going to have to wait years to get the game. And just to contextualize that, making the molds for the miniatures is the most complex and usually the longest part of the process. The other thing that we could have done better, in my opinion, is really gone more into the crunchy details of the game itself. We felt like our Kickstarter page was already so long because of all the information we were trying to convey. We decided not to go too much into the nuts and bolts of the game. My assumption was that over the course of the campaign, I would be able to dive more into that. However, and this is again due to our lack of experience from the backer side of Kickstarter, we've only been creators for Kickstarter, is we didn't understand that the core Kickstarter audience, that is what they want. They want the chunky, like gritty detail. Tell me why your game is different, right? So there's a lot of people that go onto the Kickstarter page that aren't, you know, engaging in the comment section, just like in anything, right? Like it's the 80-20 rule, like 20% of the audience is accounting for 80% of the feedback. However, that's totally fair. And that's the part that I love the most, is the crunchy mechanics and getting really into the nitty gritty. So I was kicking myself that we didn't do more of that. We added it as we went, but the vast majority of people that check out your Kickstarter page are in the first and the last 48 hours. So not having that on there was definitely a misstep and one that we'll correct in the future. And I'm going to be working between now and the time that we deliver the product in the next the subsequent Kickstarters to really, really dive into the mechanics, because for one, that's my favorite part of this whole process. And for two, as I said, that was something we definitely could have done better to help show the backers why is our game different. The other thing that we definitely should have done and did not, again, just due to a lack of experience of understanding the Kickstarter community, was having third-party reviews. That was by far the biggest point of feedback that we got was, hey, you've done a really good job having these extremely polished videos of the game, kind of like showing how the game is played, et cetera. But it feels a little bit like a sales pitch. I want to hear my trusted reviewer say what they think about your game, which totally makes sense. When I go to look to buy a new video game or board game or whatever the case may be, that's one of the first things I do. Like on Steam, I scroll down to the reviews. Like I read the like little briefly, what is the game? Watch the video. If it piques my interest, I then go right down to the reviews. So totally makes sense. That was the biggest mistake that we made in our first Kickstarter campaign, was not getting those third-party reviews. It's definitely something we're going to do. It's definitely something we're going to do going forward and make it a top priority. I think it's more important, you know, in retrospect, than having the extremely polished videos that we did have, because we had a ton of really, really cool videos. So lesson learned, right? Like, I'm extremely confident that when reviewers get our game, they're going to be like, oh, wow, these miniatures are amazing. The setup is amazing. It's visually very impressive. It's a cool game. So I think it's only going to help us, and we'll definitely make that a higher priority for the future. The part you might be asking yourself, as I did, was how the heck do you get a review copy of the game to a reviewer before you've made the game, right? So typically speaking, what you do is you get a prototype version, and then you maybe one or two. It's difficult and expensive to do. I won't dive into the prototyping process on this episode. It's way too much to talk about, but we will talk about that in a future episode. But what you do basically is reach out to popular reviewers. You do have to pay for it, and it's usually reasonable, but we'll dive into that. I'll talk about it as we go through the process. You get them the prototype copy, and you kind of give them, like, you know, a rough version of the rule book. It might even, you know, not have graphics or whatever, very simple ones. And you just have to schedule it way out in advance. They're often very busy, and they'll dive in, and they know what to do. From people I've talked to in the industry that have done this with their games, they're used to working with, you know, not entirely polished prototype versions of the game. That's something that you want to think about when you're gearing up for your Kickstarter, which again, you really want to give yourself like 6 months to start getting everything lined up, like getting your intro video, right? Like you don't have to do one as fancy as we did. Some of the most successful Kickstarters I've seen are just someone talking into a camera, right? It really is. What I've learned most about this is I think we were hyper-focused on the polished aspect of it, when the hardcore gamers and then the Kickstarter super backers, they're more interested in the content, right? And presenting that in a genuine manner is going to be the best thing you can do, even if it doesn't look as nice. Like one of the biggest points of feedback that we got as we went through the Kickstarter was people were like, oh, I can sense how passionate you are about your own project. That makes me more confident in it. And that had nothing to do with making it look cool or having, you know, amazing visual effects or any of this other stuff. So lesson learned, you know, like very similar to what you see with some of the best YouTubers is they may not have a very polished or polished at all presentation. They're just genuine and they're excited about what they're talking about and their audience can sense that. The other, I think, I wouldn't call it a major misstep, but I would say it was one of the missteps we had in our process was we were really clear and honest about shipping. Our plan was to ship everything from the United States because we have a ton of experience in logistics with shipping. We have an e-commerce business at Frontline Gaming. So we ship a ton of packages every day. We're very, very experienced. We also do freight. We do LTL, LCL. For those of you who are like, what the heck is that? That's basically shipping freight in a big rig. So we're very experienced in the logistics aspect of this industry. So we felt very confident. What we did underestimate was how many international backers there are on Kickstarter. I came into this having done a ton of research and I just missed that. Like we thought the majority of our customers would be in the United States. Our shipping rates within the United States were extremely aggressive. And that's because we have good rates. We do high volume of shipping. Some of the people that reviewed our Kickstarter page, which there wasn't a ton, but the few that did, some of them expressed incredulity that we'd be actually be able to deliver on that price. So that amused me because, you know we can deliver that because we do it every day. What did throw us for a loop, though, or what threw the backers for a loop was how expensive international shipping is. So we didn't pad the price. We weren't saying like, you know, trying to add extra money on to make money on the shipping. That's literally how much it costs to ship a big heavy box from the United States to another country, especially countries such as in Europe where they have value-added tax that gets tacked onto it. So that was a mistake on our part. We should have, I thought we did the research, but we obviously missed it. I should have looked, okay, what is the ratio typically of international to domestic orders for United States-based Kickstarters? So we had to scramble mid-campaign to find a solution, right? So typically what this looks like is you have localized shipping hubs or you can ship direct from China if you're making your game in China, but you may not be. And that mitigates the cost quite a bit. However, that means you have to get individual freight shipments to different regions like Australia, Europe, et cetera, which makes it a lot more complicated for you as the creator. It also is expensive. Instead of one container or two containers or whatever it is coming to where you're located and then you distributing from there or you sending it to a distributor, which is more common. We actually have a facility. We have a distribution facility at our HQ, so we're going to distribute the game ourselves. But it adds an extra degree of complexity, right? So how much product do you ship to these fulfillment centers or distribution centers in these various areas? What are the best locations for them? It's quite complex. Thankfully, we've done this before. We've worked with distributors in Australia and Europe before, so we have that experience. However, it's something to think about because if you, say, send a pallet of your game to a distributor in Australia or Europe or wherever the case may be, and you don't sell all of them and they're just sitting there, it's going to cost you money. Most distributors charge you to store the product, and then they charge you again when they pick and pull, which means when they go and get it and fulfill the order. So it really bites into your margin a lot. It's just something to consider. However, the backer gets sticker shock when they see, you know, $100 shipping or even more in some cases, and they get upset. Nobody likes paying for shipping, right? Amazon has spoiled all of us. But that is how much it actually costs. So we had to shift gears mid-campaign because we're like, oh man, we're missing out on all these potential backers because we underestimated how many people would be in another country. And we don't, you know, we want it to be affordable for everyone. Now, we did fix it. My business partner, Frankie, who is the logistics expert in our company, figured it all out. But by the time we got it sorted out, created the new asset, put it up, put out a new update on our campaign saying, hey, we figured out how to get this cheaper for international, we missed out on probably 50% or more of the total traffic we were going to get to our Kickstarter page. So that was a big mistake. So you definitely want to do a ton of research before you get ready so that you can be prepared for things like this. It's a bit ironic as well, because we came into this knowing that the logistics side of a Kickstarter campaign is often the Achilles heel for many companies that kind of, for lack of a better word, screw it up. We know personally people that have had a successful Kickstarter and then lost money because they didn't understand the shipping part of it. And there's a bunch of Kickstarters out there currently that have been years and years and years and they haven't fulfilled, and they're trying to charge backers, you know, tons of extra money because they got a shipping rate before COVID prices. And they did, and this is speaking from experience, they did go up a ton during COVID. They're starting to come back down. So they were in a position where they were in the red, right? Like they were going to lose money on their project. So you want to make sure that you understand that part of it as best you possibly can, so that you can set a realistic expectation for a potential backer, not put yourself in a position where you're going to take a loss, or you have to go back to the backer and say, the only way I can get this to you is if you pay me even more money, which, you know, fairly infuriates people. And that would make me super upset too. So you just want to make sure that you have your ducks lined up on that before you dive into the deep end of the pool. The other thing that I learned in this process of doing more research on, okay, well, how the heck does a company that has a game that's of a similar size and weight physically as ours post these insanely low prices? And as I was digging and digging, I was like, oh, a lot of them just lie. Or I should say it appears that they lie. They basically do what's called a bait and switch. Or it appears, I don't want to cast aspersions that are unfair. It seems like some of these companies just simply do a bait and switch where they go, oh yeah, we can ship a 10-pound box or a 15-pound box halfway around the world for $20. And then they go through the process, everything's done, the project gets funded, and then they go to the backer and say, oh, just kidding, it's actually $120, right? And that's obviously, you know, unethical and setting yourself up for long-term failure. So make sure that you don't put yourself in a position where you feel tempted to do that in order to get more pledges, you know, a short-term gain for a long-term loss, or just through ignorance that you're stuck in that position. The other thing I learned in the process of doing our first board game Kickstarter was, while the Kickstarter is going, don't expect to get really much of anything done. Now, we knew that the month before the Kickstarter would be hectic. It turned out that the 2 months before were insanely busy. But we kind of thought that once it was up and running, it would be relatively easy. It's like, okay, answer some questions, make any adjustments that you need to make. Totally wrong. Basically expect to spend the majority, if not all of your day when the Kickstarter is going, especially in the first week and the last week, doing nothing else or a minimal of anything else. You need to really set aside a lot of time. And then after the Kickstarter, you need to set aside a lot of time to go through all the logistics of, you know, doing any surveys you want to do, collecting all the data, setting up your pledge manager. You know, now Kickstarter thankfully has announced that they're going to do a pledge manager. Frankly, I have no idea why they hadn't done it already. They're just leaving money on the table. But we're going with GameFound, which, if anybody's still interested in the game, please check that out. You can still get it. It's a whole new system. You have to learn a whole new software. You have to upload the images. There's differences. There are different sizes. We had to go through and edit every single one of our graphical assets to fit on GameFound. You have to understand how to use the software. The back end of GameFound can be pretty challenging to use. The front end, I think, is amazing. Their customer service is really good as well. But it's a whole new thing you have to learn. So you want to make sure that you're ready to do that before you even do your Kickstarter. So I made the mistake of thinking, oh, it's probably very similar to Kickstarter. I poked around a little bit, but it took me a little bit longer to get everything up and running on GameFound than I thought it would. You know, on top of that, I was sick, which is a part of it. But that also ended up being much, much more time consuming than I had assumed it would have been. So in the future, what I would do is I would get the Kickstarter or whatever service you're going to use, and the backer kit and the late pledge, all of that done before you even begin, so that you can focus strictly on giving great customer service, answering questions, interacting with potential backers. Long story short on that topic is the actual process of going through the Kickstarter is very, very time intensive. So just plan that out. You know, if you're have another job or loved ones, because it definitely put a strain on my relationship, how unpresent I was for months. Just make sure that you're prepared for that. Lastly, as this has already run longer than the podcast normally is, and I don't want it to drag on for too long, is don't run your Kickstarter coinciding with another major event in your life. For example, as I had mentioned earlier, we were running the Las Vegas Open, which is a huge event. Now, it was great to get the game in front of so many people live, but trying to focus on running, you know, one of the largest tabletop gaming events in North America and running the launch of a Kickstarter, plus my wife and my family were there, so I had familial obligations. It was just too much at once. I was only sleeping a couple hours a night. Nothing was getting done as well as it could have if I had time to focus. So that's another lesson learned. Going forward, we'll probably announce a new product in the Blood Throne family at the LVO, because that makes sense. But we'll give ourselves time to focus on running a great event and then get some cool down and then ramp up to the next one. I think that that's just a smarter way of doing things. We had looked at Catalyst Games Battletech, which is blown up, and I'm happy about it. I'm happy for them. They're really nice guys and gals in my interactions with them. And I love Battletech. It was a game that got me into tabletop gaming, that and D&D. But they launched one of their most successful, I believe it was their most successful Kickstarter at Gen Con. So we looked at that and we said, oh, okay, maybe we can mimic that. But the difference is they weren't running Gen Con. they were running their booth and then doing their Kickstarter. We were trying to run, you know, Gen Con's much bigger than LVO, but it was a little too much at once. So for your first or any Kickstarter, really, unless you have a teammate that's all they're doing, that's all they're focused on, make it easy on yourself. Do it at a time when you can really, really focus so that you can do it as well as you possibly can. In all, we are so thankful that we had a successful Kickstarter. We've been working on this project, as I mentioned, for years and years. This has been a dream of mine since I was a child. So thank you again to everybody that helped make it come to life. If you are interested in still backing the project, you can do so on GameFound. Just look up Blood Throne. I'll, of course, put links in the associated posts. And we'll be back onto a regular schedule. I had some more things I wanted to cover, but I don't want this to go too long. We try to keep it 30 minutes or less. Thank you for listening. It's great to be back. Please answer any or ask any questions that you may have, and I will try to answer as many as possible in the next podcast. And we cannot wait to see how people react when they get Blood Throne in their hands.